All ADAPT actions are nonviolent.
That unruffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, and alongside his team saturated in talent, Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman and Mary Edgerton, and our irreplaceable media maven, engineer, and honors graduate, Tatiana Kago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls before returning us safely to the present. First of all, I want to thank all of you on behalf of our team for another successful fund drive. What you did was to tell us to keep the magic of stories alive, and we aim to do so. We love you all, and we plan to be around for a long time. Right, Tatiana?
Absolutely.
That's it? Absolutely?
Well, we're not going anywhere, that's for sure.
Well, we certainly want to keep your high-paid job, so, you know, now that you're going to graduate school, I don't know how you can possibly beat this. But, nevertheless, we thank you so much. In the words of Joel Osteen, I like to start with something funny. Is that a good imitation? Anybody? For those of you?
Okay, I thought he was in the booth with us.
Okay, well, whatever. A young man begs his girlfriend to marry him, asserting that he'd do anything to win her love. She responds with the terrible request. To prove your love, you must kill your mother. He's appalled by her demand and refuses, but she makes it clear that if denied, he will lose her love forever. He succumbs, and one night, while standing next to his mother in the kitchen, he takes a butcher knife and stabs her in the heart. He runs to leave the scene of the crime, and in his haste, trips on a rug and falls. His mother, barely alive, sees her son falls and lifts her head and whispers, "Did you hurt yourself?" Funny? Maybe not. I didn't think so when my grandmother told me the story when I was a kid. I learned later that this quirky tale of dark humor was about the power of a mother's love, a love that forever remains regardless of circumstance. I got it. We all got it. It's a kind of lingering love. Well, tonight, we treat lingering love with more listenable stories where none of the characters are tested by performing terrible deeds at the request of terrible people. Instead, tonight's tellers convey precious images that linger in their hearts after losing ones they love. And these stories will be told by some of the best tellers around. New to our program are Nicole Holloway Spafford and Joanne Williams, and veteran guest and guest host, Harwood Taylor. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Are you really nervous? Joanne, are you nervous yet? You look
yet.
Petrified. But your daughter is here, right, Valerie?
Yeah.
Yeah? Tell us about her. Tell us about her a little bit, because she's out there giving you some moral support.
She is your twin.
Honest to God. She is your twin.
She is my best support.
You look a little younger
world.
Than her. But
oh, thanks.
That's okay. But yes, absolutely.
She wouldn't like
that. Right. And you brought somebody for support, didn't you?
I did not.
You did not? Who's that guy you came with?
That's Margo's support.
Yeah, that's Margo's support.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, somebody's got support somewhere, right?
That's right.
Chris
tons
is
of it.
Here.
That's right. Okay. You got our support.
All right, whatever.
Absolutely.
Listen, Joanne, let's kick it off with you. Dallas-born Joanne Williams is a ceramicist and jewelry designer who met her late husband in the art department at UT. She earned a master's in art therapy from Pratt Institute. In 2000, Joanne initiated a nonprofit called ArtBridge to offer therapeutic arts programs to homeless children around Houston. You know, we know that storytelling is a form of art. My wife and I were watching a program on Memorial Day that spotlighted soldiers telling their war stories to other warriors to make them feel whole. And I know, Joanne, that art therapy can be used for anyone of any age who suffers from a range of mental disorders to learning disabilities. Like, sort of like the case of stories used by wounded warriors, give us an example of how a specific type of art can help someone with a particular disorder.
Okay, well, for instance, children often don't have the words necessary to explain or describe their feelings. So I give them a large circle to draw in. The circle drawings are often called mandalas, and they provide a soft yet contained boundary, and then once they do the drawing can be talked about. The same thing happens with severely traumatized people. They need first to create a place of safety. The mandala form becomes their safe place. Once they're able to talk about their drawings, the healing begins. Yeah. So art therapy opens up communication.
Yeah, it really does. Great. That's beautiful, yeah. And I know that when we talked about this earlier, I had mentioned schizophrenia because I know people who are schizophrenics, and for them, instead of using words, they use art to communicate feelings and affect. And it's really quite extraordinary. You met your husband in the art department at University of Texas.
I did.
And what did he do in the world of art?
Well, my husband, Casey Williams, was first a photographer and then an art professor. He got his MFA from the San Francisco Art Institute in the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. And he became one of the photographers, one of the forefront of photography as a fine art movement. He was one of the initial photographers to have his work shown in museums and art galleries.
Wow.
Casey had a retrospective at the CAM here in Houston in 1993.
Yeah, wow.
Wonderful.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. I ambush you at the Moth. I ambush Nicole. I ambush everybody at the Moth. That's what I do for a living. A few months ago, because like the rest of the 400 plus people in the audience, I was taken by your sense of detail and imagery in your story. And you called your story Tornado Bathroom. It illustrates, a number of things. But it's also a timely tribute, I think, to the devastating weather rumbling through parts of the Midwest right now. Tell us a story.
Okay. My hometown of Dallas, Texas is right in the middle of what they call Tornado Alley. We had a family plan to prepare for tornadoes by sheltering in the most interior room in the house, the girls' bathroom, which was the only room in the house without a window. This was the pink bathroom covered in floor-to-ceiling pink tile, but it was known as the Tornado Bathroom. It was the one I shared with my sister Linda. And in the event of an emergency, we would have filled the pink bathtub with water. I don't remember ever actually rehearsing this, our family drill, but my sister and I certainly sheltered in place from our parents in there to commiserate. Linda and I held our daily conferences in there, where crucial information was shared while getting ready for school, getting ready for dates, talking about boys, gossiping, and smoking our first cigarettes. It had a large mirror mounted on the wall above a vanity where we fought for space, and spent enough time in there that Mom wrote notes for us on the mirror with an eyebrow pencil. It was our safe place, no matter the weather. The summer after my graduation from high school, I was 17 and had a romance with an 8 years older guy who was a guitar player and singer in a band. It was thrilling at first, but then he got way more serious and I realized I might be in over my head. He was from Houston, but was traveling back and forth to Dallas all that summer with his band. Our interactions were intense, but luckily brief, since he always had to leave. It worked for me because I was way too immature and flaky to handle much more. One day towards the end of summer, close to my departure for college, this musician showed up unannounced at our house with gifts for my whole family. Carefully thought out gifts for Linda and for Mom and for me. A ring with a solitaire that I can barely remember because I snapped the box open and closed it so fast and put it on the coffee table. In my panic, I responded by running to the tornado bathroom and slamming the door locked. After possibly an hour had passed, Mom knocked on the door trying to get me to come back out, and Linda gently scratched at the door to get me to open it up. She slipped a piece of paper under the door where she had written, "Joe, he's crying." They whispered for me to please come out, but I felt unable to leave the tornado bathroom. I can't say how long it took for the musician to finally go away, but he did after what seemed like hours. I never spoke to the guy again, and I never resolved it with him nor with myself. I left for college in Austin, where I fell in crazy love with a law student named Gaines Griffin, who was tall and handsome and wore Aramis cologne, which smelled so sophisticated at the time. I was only a freshman, but, oh, I knew he was the one. By summer, he had broken it off with me by unceremoniously disappearing. I went home to Dallas heartbroken and fell into a decline. I spent about a week in my bed, refused to eat, weeping and dramatically moping about, until Mom made the command, "Get out of bed and get over it." I was able to make my way to the tornado bathroom, where I spent a good amount of time gazing at my pitiful self in the mirror. And in my malnourished state, I fainted, fell over, taking the vanity chair down with me to the floor. When I was able to get up, my leg hurt like hell, and when I raised the long, dirty T-shirt I had been wearing for about a week, I saw the reflection of a giant, purple hematoma running from my hip to my knee in the shape of a spectacular purple heart.
You know, the the purple heart. Now tell us how you felt when you realized that.
Well, maybe I was hallucinating. I hadn't eaten for about a week.
Yeah.
And when I turned to look at it, and everything was done in front of this mirror in the bathroom. When I turned to look at it, I looked at it very carefully, and maybe I hallucinated it, but it sure looked like a big purple heart to me.
Yeah, yeah. And let's talk about the lingering notion. What is it that you miss about something in that episode that you would consider to be lingering love?
Well, I think that when I first started...
The guy cried for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah, when I first started as an art therapist, we often had to draw our safe place. And when I thought about it and thought about it, I thought, I'm going to draw the tornado bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to draw a big pink bathroom. And when I did, you know, it was very sad because I didn't live there any longer. My parents didn't live there any longer.
Right.
And
right.
I thought, wow, that was a safe place for
me.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah. And one of the reasons I love this story, and it'll be very apparent, it is apparent, is that lingering love isn't just about a person. It's not just that soulmate that you end up with. It can be a space. It could be a thing. It could be a stuffed animal.
Right.
It could be a number of things. And what I love about the sensitivity behind that story is the sort of different beaten path that you've taken to talk about that lingering affection that you still feel. And I love that. I love that.
Right.
Of all the lessons embedded in that narrative, Joanne, which is the single most important that you want us to take from it?
Well, basically, karma is a B word,
mm-hmm.
of course,
mm-hmm.
and irony is everything.
Yeah.
But having a place of safety where you can work out conflicts is priceless
yeah,
to me.
It really is. It is. I don't think there are that many places where we can do that. Native Houstonian, we're going to move to Nicole. Native Houstonian, Nicole Holloway Spafford, graduated from Baylor with a double major in political science and history. Currently, her job in oil and gas has her commuting between Austin and Houston. She's always enjoyed writing and self-published a novel, as a matter of fact. It served therapeutic, but after her husband, Jared, died, it was hard for her to express feelings in her writing. She's been a fan of The Moth, so when in Houston on that Tuesday, Nicole decided to tell a story. The story that moved us all, the story you'll hear in a moment, because for her, it seemed like a beautiful way to keep his memory alive while allowing her to grieve. In many ways, it's sort of her safe space, I think it's safe to say. And I think this is an accurate expose of a love story. Nicole, I hope you agree, and I want to thank you for allowing me to share that with our listeners. Tell us your story.
So, I had this stalker once, and he was relentless. And like magic, every time I changed my phone number, he would get it instantly. And after years of avoiding him at all costs and multiple phone number changes, we came to agreement. We would be 90-day phone friends. All I had to do was answer my phone once every 90 days, have a simple conversation, and it would keep the peace, and I could keep my phone number. And it was at that moment I knew the political science degree I was working towards in college was not going to set me on a path to become the first female president of the United States, because obviously I would negotiate with terrorists. But the night before I graduated from college, I was driving out to our family graveyard so that I could talk to my grandmother about all my fears for this next chapter of my life. And I realized during that drive that it had been almost 90 days since I had spoken to him, and he was seeing this girl, and I just really wanted to know what was going on with it, because he was actually seeing someone who already had a boyfriend, and her boyfriend had mistakenly thought he was her gay friend, and he didn't correct it so that he could continue to see this girl without any suspicion from the boyfriend. And you have to know about me that I have to binge watch all of my TV shows, because waiting a week to find out what happens is just too much. So having to wait 90 days to find out the next installment of this ridiculous situation he got himself into had me on the edge of my seat. So as I'm driving down the road and dialing my stalker's phone number, I had to accept that we might actually be friends. And then fast forward months down the road, and I was just having a really bad day. And all of a sudden, I got this random text from my friendly stalker, and it was just some song lyrics, but it made me smile. And at this point, we were actually living about 7 hours apart, because I had gone off to college. He moved away from Houston, where we met, and I saw that text, and I just knew I had to see him. So I called him, and I asked him to drive the 7 hours to come see me, because I didn't think that was too much to ask of someone who once stalked you. And he agreed. And in typical stalker fashion, he quit his job. He got a new job in Houston, and he never left. And as the years went by, this friendship developed into a relationship based on some of our common interests. Come to find out, stalking was one of those. And that was something I had to accept whenever I not only agreed to, but planned most of the weekend outings to all corners of the country, following a band around that we both really enjoyed, where we would sit hours after the concert by their tour bus, just hoping to meet them. And during these years, he would always ask me if I was ever going to marry him. And every single time my answer was the same. I said, hell the F no. Until one day I said, hell no. And it was that day that he called my parents, asked for their blessing, bought a ring, and 2 days later, he asked me to marry him. And as he sat there with that ring and a shaking hand, I agreed to spend the rest of my life with him. But what neither of us realized at that time was I was really just agreeing to spend the rest of his life with him. Because 2 years ago on Valentine's Day, I woke up to discover that his life was over. And I still drive out to my family graveyard to talk to my grandmother, but it's also where I go to talk to my best friend, my husband, and one-time stalker about all my fears for this next chapter of my life.
Oh my goodness. You know, all of us have the same expression. It's, yeah. My gosh, you know, that's a man who knew what he wanted, and he got the right thing, didn't he? You.
Yes.
You have to feel
good about
that.
I hope he felt that way.
You know he did. You know that he felt that way, right?
Yes.
What a beautiful story. What a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story. You know, you do merge humor with sadness effortlessly, I think, to create a very unique tone. At what point do you give yourself permission to tell a personal story in public? A story like that.
I feel like it was not so much about giving myself permission. It was more of a compulsion.
Mm-hmm.
I felt, you know, I miss him. And you want to share this person that meant so much to your life with other people.
Yeah.
And it just got to a point where I felt like I had to share him with the world.
Yeah.
As much that would hear it.
That's a gorgeous sentiment. It really is. That's a beautiful, beautiful sentiment. What's the most important message from your story that you want everyone to remember?
Have courage to always go after what you want in life and laugh along the way, because determination and laughter really defined who Jared was.
Magnificent formula. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite binge show watching?
Oh, gosh. So many.
Here's one.
I'll give you one that me and Jared like to binge.
That makes totally good sense.
And Breaking Bad.
Okay, me too.
Yeah.
Me too. Say my name.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
What? I don't have any clue what, you know, yeah. Yeah, you do.
Yeah, you do.
I'm the cook. I'm the guy who killed Gus Fring.
Mm-hmm.
Bull. You know, blah, blah, blah. Cartel killed Fring. You sure? That's right. Now, say my name, Heisenberg. You're D.D. Wright. I can go on and on. What do you want to hear next? Leave it to Beaver? I know that from the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not a well person when it comes to, I know TV. Yeah. You know, I'm also convinced, off the subject, but not really, it occurred to me the other day that the best way for our elementary school children to learn about life is to watch every episode of Andy Griffith.
Absolutely.
Okay? Right? It's Lincoln-esque. Every conceivable lesson about ethics, moral, love, understanding, active listening. Right, Tatiana? She has no idea what I'm talking about. She has no idea. Yeah, okay, yeah, sure. Dr. Rubinchek, whatever you say, you gave me the A. All right, okay. If you just tuned in, this is Hank Rubinchek with Tatiana Gago, and you are enjoying Stories of Lingering Love by guest tellers Nicole Holloway Spafford, Harwood Taylor, and Joanne Williams, only on KPFT 90.1 Houston, 89.5 with our friends in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Belgian painter Eric Pivajans, I learned how to pronounce that, by the way, I'm a stickler with that,
well
says
done.
Of loss, we should appeal to the opulent granary of our memory and explore the green pastures lingering in our mind. Dr. Seuss professes the same for our kids. Don't cry because it ended, smile because it happened. Now, these thoughts of lingering love apply to every story told tonight, but it's especially apparent in Harwood's story about his brother. Harwood Taylor is a longtime friend and supporter of So What's Your Story, and along with another dazzling teller, Chris Gorman, who's in the studio tonight, serve as guest hosts on the show. In fact, they're going to be here on June 20th. Harwood is the gallery director of Gremillion. How's that?
Well done.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I used to say Gremillion. You know, I sounded like Beverly Hillbilly. Okay,
no.
And company. It's a Houston institution in and of itself, I might add, is a Moth champion a few times over, and a very dear friend to everyone on the team, and I'm happy to say that, because friends, they rock.
I feel the same way about all of you.
And that's pretty remarkable. Pretty remarkable. Harwood, you know, the Gremillion website reads, encouraging thoughtful perception. Tell us how to make that happen when meandering through your gallery.
Well, I would invite you all to come in and have a cup of tea and let me just talk to you about art. I realized once when I took an art history class that this guy was giving me this amazing information, and I was writing down everything, and I thought, wow, this is what I do for a living. I mean, this is what it must feel like. And I never really thought about it. It's storytelling, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but I think very quickly, just as a story can, you know, change your life, how you feel, how you think about something. A few words when standing in front of a painting and looking at it can change everything about how you feel about it.
Yeah.
And I literally mean in 30 seconds having somebody go, I would never want an abstract painting to, or I hate blue. I mean, my favorite thing was I hate blue, and then they end up getting this 7x5 foot cobalt blue, which is a really blue blue painting. And it's really just that they've never seen a painting that was blue that they liked, you know. So I don't know. That's not.
But I love that. I love that. I love that phrase, encouraging thoughtful perception. I really love that. You or your mom who came up with that?
No. This was Ron Grimion, and Ron was my mentor. He's the owner of the gallery, and I think it also means that, I mean, there are galleries where people sit behind the desk and really don't give you much feedback, and I don't, you know, pounce on people when they walk in, but I just ask kindly, would you like me to tell you something about the exhibition? And most people do want to hear that. Yeah. Some people don't, but most do, and that little bit of information... Mm-hmm. And then sometimes when somebody says, you know, I don't like this, instead of just saying, okay, well, let's find something you do like, I'll say, okay, I understand that. Let me just tell you a couple of things about it. I'm not going to try to get you to buy this today or something. And by saying those few things, their eye is opened, their heart is open, their mind is opened. I mean, that's what encouraging thoughtful perception is.
And your stories do the same thing, by the way. You know, you're a member of the Let Me Rip Your Heart Open with My Story group. I think that's probably a good category.
All right.
And after tonight, you'll probably have a couple of other joining in that organization.
Good.
The story about your brother, to which I earlier referred, is another one of those examples. But I mean that in the most positive sense of the word. It resonates so clearly, just like Joanne's and Nicole's stories, and hopefully the one I'm going to tell a little bit later. And I think that's what these stories about integration of lingering love do. Tell us a story.
All right. Well, I just start with, my mom was unconventional in the sense that for her age person, she was 40 when she had me, so she's a little bit older mom. But she had already married twice. She'd had kids so that meant three men that we knew of. And so she was kind of wild. She was an artist herself. So this, have this clear memory. It was 1972, and my brother walked in the door. It was Christmas Day. I was totally psyched about this because I'm 7 years old. My brother hung the moon. He's also 13 years older, so just seeing him was special because he didn't live with us. He was newly married. And he was bringing in a present. It was perfectly wrapped. I knew exactly what it was by the size and shape of it. It was a toy car called a Hot Wheel. It had a flat panel and a little bulge on the bottom where the, you know, car sat. So I'm like, you know, I didn't say it out loud. But it was kind of like, give me that. You know, I grabbed it, ripped it open. And it was a Hot Wheel with moving parts. And that was novel, too. There weren't a lot of Hot Wheels with moving parts at that time. I think that, anyway, it had some kind of mechanism. And I just think, you know, what a sweet guy. You know, he not only got a Hot Wheel, but he got a Hot Wheel with moving parts. And about, I don't know, you know, within months later, Jerry was on his way down to Surfside to surf. And he was in a car accident. And he always told us to wear a seatbelt. He had worn a seatbelt that day, but the car flipped over and he hit his head and he went into a coma. The next day I was in school, I was in second grade, and someone came to our homeroom and said, is Harwood Taylor here? And they took me to the office with my sister. They brought us home, and my family was all there in the living room, and some neighbors, and they told us that Jerry had died. And I had never seen everyone cry at once. And just my, you know, something had broken in my world. And I have this very clear memory. There was this low, black, long table. And I walked up on it and I looked at everybody. My sister told me this, you know, and I smiled and I said, don't worry, he'll be back. And everybody laughed, you know. But I wasn't trying to be funny. I was just 7, and I had both my grandparents still living. I mean, I didn't have any fish or hamsters or friends, or no one had died. So the idea of somebody going away and never coming back, I just didn't have a place to put that. So, yeah, of course he's going to come back. Well, he didn't come back. And I never let him die, though. And when I say that, I mean I lied about it. So when parents, friends, or whoever would say, you know, so do you have brothers and sisters? I'd say, yes, I have Robin and Laura Lee, and then I have my brother Jerry. And then other things that I used my brother for before and after his death was there was a bully in the neighborhood, and I would say, hey, man, you better cut it out, or, you know, because my big brother's going to be here, and he's going to come and kick your butt, you know. And, until one day I used that, got into a fix. Hey, you know, my brother's going to be here in just a minute, and he's going to kick your butt. And this kid said, your brother's dead. And I just ran. And I ran that day, and I ran emotionally probably until about 5 years ago, if I'm really honest. And I mean that I didn't let people in. I just knew that death was a possibility. I didn't want to re-experience that. The more friends I had, the more chance I had of having to go experience someone's death. So I also had these vivid dreams of Jerry. Into my 20s, even in my 30s. I mean, they were so real. I'd wake up and I'd think, am I dreaming now that I'm in bed? Because that was so real. I mean, it was one of those, and then when I was in my late 30s, and my dad was in his late 70s, my father gets into the car. I had a breakfast with him once a week. He was a writer, and he was very fastidious about letters and, you know, even the way he opened a letter. He hands it to me, and if he had opened it with a letter opener, you kind of cut the edge of the letter and so passed it to me. I slide this thing out. It's a letter and a birth certificate, and it says, hi, my name is Robert Donathan. I was put up for a sealed adoption many years ago, and I'm looking for my mom, Audrey LaRue. Audrey LaRue was my mom. She became Audrey LaRue Taylor. And it said, you know, and it had the birth certificate. And I said, well, Daddy, it looks like I have a half-brother, you know. And he goes, well, it doesn't make sense because Jerry would have been that same age. And I looked at the birth certificate and I said, no, he's almost exactly 1 year older than Jerry would have been. It was unbelievable. And then I looked down and I saw her signature. My mother was a painter, and I said, Daddy, that's her signature. And my dad, now I know, was starting to get Alzheimer's, and so he immediately went, oh my gosh, you're right. So all these years later, my brother came back. And I know that Robert Donathan is not Jerry, but it feels so good to have my brother back.
I've heard it before, but I'm always, you know, it's one of those stories that you think about, and there are so many features to it that are incredible. It's irony, it's magic, it's coincidence, it's your mom. It's amazing. You're close with your brother, you're close with him.
You know, the truth is we have nothing in common. I mean, just, you know, I'm very much into the art world and all that. He doesn't really have that kind of, you know, life. He's a businessman. He's, I'm super liberal. He's super conservative, you know, but I miss Jerry so much, you know, to this day. Right. I mean, there's just like, my sisters told me that he really doted on me, and I guess I just got that energetically. Even though he died when I was 7, I just got kind of bathed in his love.
And he was how much older than you?
He was 13 years. 13. So Robert is 14 years. Mm-hmm. So it's literally like having my brother back. It's just, and so, you know, when I sit with him, I mean, it doesn't even matter what we're doing. It just, you know, walking with him, he's kind. Just energetically. And I know he feels the same way. It's like he's reconnected with his family that he didn't know that he had. And so I think we'll always have an amazing connection. So whenever I go to Austin, which I do for business from time, I spend time with him and his wife and
Carol. It's an
amazing
story. I love that story.
I do too.
I love a lot of your stories. But this one, you know, your stories are always, in my opinion, at least smothered with messages.
Yeah.
And I know you, so it's more intriguing to me because I see how they actually define you. So when I think about Harwood and his persona, I see how these stories create that. Does that make sense?
Sure.
What's the most essential lesson from this story that we dare not forget?
Well, first thing that comes to mind is that we just don't know what life will bring. We have no clue. I can tell you, you know, although with my mom, there was a part of me that went, oh, yeah, of course there was a child that she never told anyone about. Yeah, so I think just kind of realizing that there really is magic in yeah. life. If I mean, you don't have to make it up. It's happening, I think, if we're awake to it.
This next question, it's a quick hitter, but it probably makes all the sense of the world at this point. Answer true or false. Everyone becomes mortal if they're in a story.
Yeah, you mean immortal.
Yeah, immortal. Excuse me.
Yeah.
I have mortal because you were just talking about you never know. So I had the word mortal on my mind. Sure, but yeah, sure. Immortal.
Yeah.
Immortal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. True?
Absolutely.
Yeah. True,
yeah.
You think?
Absolutely.
Nicole, what
True.
Do you think? Yeah. Well, all of your stories would certainly reinforce that. Mm-hmm. And whatever we may think, we know one thing for sure, and that's Tatiana is our goddess, and that makes her immortal in our eyes. Right, Tatiana?
Yeah.
So why don't you, So why don't you tell us what's going on in H-Town in terms of storytelling?
Well, first of all, thank you for actually seeing me for who I really am. Thank mm-hmm. you for acknowledging
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
And Houston is truly a hub for storytelling. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset, directly across from Rice University. It's a great place to tell stories to a supportive group of like-minded people. Their next swap is June 25th. Go to www.houstonstorytellers.org for more information, especially about joining the guild. While you're there, click on the radio program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of shows since 2008, so you better get started. But you don't need a radio to listen to our show. You can listen online at www.kpft.org. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. In short, we are all over the place. Also, if you have any program ideas or comments for anyone on our team, drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and we will get back to you. We promise. Our friends at The Moth hold a story slam at Warehouse Live on the second Tuesday of the month, and June is a special month because their regular story swap on Tuesday, June 25th, will be augmented by the Grand Slam held at the ballroom at Bayou Place on Wednesday, June 19th. Get your tickets at themoth.org. The theme for the 11th is Chemistry, and the heat is on for the Grand Slam. Next week, Mary will host Sharon Dorsey to get us into the Father's Day season with stories from daughters to fathers. Anything else?
Well, you are really close to your dad, right?
I am, extremely.
Yeah, and I thought about that when Mary told me that she's got stories, because it's something very special. You know, I mean, obviously that doesn't minimize stories about, you know, from sons to fathers, but because certainly... Harvard's done so many of them, but there is something very special about daughters to fathers, right?
I agree.
Yeah. You and your dad are awfully
close. We have so many stories.
Yeah, well, maybe she might ask you to chime in. Warren was astonishing last week in a story on the Moth Radio Hour on Saturday. Also, a few followers learned that I'm teaching another course on crafting your personal narrative at the Women's Institute this fall, and registration is open. I'd love to see our friends in there. And by the way, Mary's guest next week is one of the freshest tellers hitting the storytelling scene, so be sure to tune in. I told Mary I thought she was funnier than Toady Fields, and then she asked me, who was Toady Fields? I said, what kind of a boomer are you, right? All of you know who Toady Fields
Absolutely.
Is, don't you? Lie to me if you don't. Okay, well,
yes.
In the meantime, look
That's
at all. Great, 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 great comedian from the Catskills years ago. Okay, never mind. Okay, I'm old. Lock me up before I strike again. I can't help that. All right. But you don't want to miss that show. And frankly, I don't know why anybody would want to miss this program, because we are indeed an icon for community radio right here in 90.1 Houston, Pacifica, fueled for peace. Joanne, how do you know when an incident that you've experienced is story worthy? I was asking Nicole earlier about permission, and she had, you know, edited that and saying that it's not so much permission as much as it is, you know, wanting to share something, wanting someone to be a part of it. But
right.
In your case, how do you know if something is story worthy?
Well, for me, when I can recall an incident or a series of incidents that I can remember in complete detail, like it happened in a movie, or if I have a visceral response or a vaguely a mysterious familiar mm-hmm. feeling.
Yeah.
I know that something about that story is important.
Yeah.
And when I recall them, you know, it's so affecting. I can begin to cry or begin to have a really intense emotional response. Mm-hmm. And I need to tell somebody, I think, hey, you know, that is so funny. Then I think, that's a story.
That's a great response. A lot of comprehensive. That's very good. That is very good. A lot of things I haven't thought about. Now, you have a story that I think is worth telling right now. It's about intentions, and it has a different topspin again on lingering love. And I think it's one of the most creative that I've heard in a while. Tell us a story.
Okay. If anyone had told me, say, in my 30s or 40s that in anticipation of retirement, I would be the owner of a 19th century adobe home in a tiny dusty town in deep west Texas, I would have poked their eyes out. I had something more in mind like Tuscany or Palm Springs. But Marfa, Texas, population 2,000, called to my husband Casey, who had spent his career as a photographer and was drawn to its plainness, the light, its forms, proportions, and color palette. The house we bought in Marfa had been built in 1899 by one of the original ranching families. It was then converted to the first medical clinic for the whole of Presidio County, and then in the 1960s converted back to a family home. Like most of the old adobe buildings in Marfa, it had deteriorated and had fallen into such disrepair that reconstruction took a full year. But this was to be our retirement home, where we would go on holidays with our family. We were going to spend more and more time there enjoying the impossibly deep blue skies and pitch-dark nights, filled with so many stars to look at them made you feel so tiny. And despite the house being 500 yards from the railroad tracks, where trains blared through six times a night, it was amazingly peaceful. Casey, my husband, carrying his trusty camera bag, took his cameras out most days, collecting images, preferring early morning and dusk to experience how the light changed. He said that through his camera he was trying to understand the place. About a year into enjoying our Marfa home, Casey was diagnosed with lymphoma and leukemia, which necessitated returning to Houston for treatments and testing every 3 months. In the space between those times, he would look forward to the 9-hour drive to return to Marfa as often as possible, and he and I lived for those opportunities. After 7 years of extensive camera treatments, he received a bone marrow transplant, which was completely successful, and he was proclaimed cancer-free. His strength began to return, and even his hair. He was free to get back to his work in Marfa. His daily routine was to photograph each evening until dusk. In Houston, these twilight hours are when the mosquitoes come out aggressively. But in Marfa, we didn't give a second thought to mosquitoes. It was so dry out there. This is a place where desert centipedes rear up on their back legs, and black widow spiders nest in the cracks, and scorpions crawl into your shoes. For avoiding snakes, he had snake gaiters, which he never wore, but was likely to say, "Oh, yeah, I meant to use those." And although insect repellent was advisable, he couldn't be relied on to use the spray. He really hated that stuff. So I bought him these off-mosquito towelettes, and I made him put them in his camera bag. Sometimes they'd even sneak a few of them in there. And he promised he would use those instead. He was healthy for a year. And then, after one long visit to Marfa, Casey came down with a mysterious fever. So protocol dictated that we take him back to MD Anderson in the event of a fever, so we did. But this fever puzzled the doctors. He was cancer-free, and it didn't seem related. He didn't respond to antibiotics, and then days later he slipped into a coma and he never got to come home again. Tropical disease specialists were called in, and after much hemming and hawing, they diagnosed West Nile virus. After 3 months of waiting and wondering, he died on New Year's Day, 2013. Yep, of a mosquito bite. When Casey was cremated, I took some of his ashes to Marfa. And then I thought it would be nice to nestle some in his old camera bag and put him back in his studio where he spent most of his time. Well, it made me mad and kind of sad to open the lid of his camera bag and to discover all of those little unopened mosquito repellent packets. I know he really did mean to use them.
Wow, that is a that's an awfully touching story. What do you think about when you think about Casey now?
Oh, man, I could have just killed
well,
him.
You know? What, yeah. What inspired you? What inspired you? What inspired that story?
Well, you know, after, I guess, as a wife, you know, who carried good intentions around for 7 years and longer, to help him, you know, to care for a sick husband for 7 years, you have to have good intentions.
Yeah, of course.
And he often had good intentions. I mean, he often would say, you know, well, I didn't do it, but I had an intention. I had good intentions. Mm-hmm. So I thought of a story. I tried to think of a time when intentions were not mm-hmm. acted upon mm-hmm. and how, you know, basically those good intentions were simply not enough in the end.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what drove the
yeah.
story.
I think we're all inspired to tell stories for so many different reasons. So many different reasons. These are great stories tonight, by the way. Aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, they really are. Thank you so much. I got to hear that one live at the Moth.
Yeah.
It's very moving.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, that you say that, because even though we've heard some of these stories before, what makes a good storyteller, which you folks are, is that when you tell the story, it sounds like it's the first time.
Yeah.
Even though you've heard it before. It just unfolds that way.
Yeah.
I was inspired for this theme, by the way, by a story about my grandfather. It's one of my favorite topics, as Harwood knows, my grandfather. And I wanted to share it at the Moth at the Love Hurts theme and wasn't called. And I have shared this privately with Warren and a couple of other people, but not publicly. And I think it fits. So if you'd indulge me, I wanted to share it tonight.
Please, Hank.
Some claim to witness souls leaving the bodies of those who just passed, cases documented by hospice nurses, doctors, faith-driven family members. And I was always a skeptic until I watched my grandfather's soul leave his body. My father left when I was 14. He wasn't a bad man, but he was sick and he was weak. But I had my grandfather who, along with my grandmother, mother and brother, lived together in a small house, not quite tiny, but close. My grandmother reigned supreme as the chief petty officer of the house, but my grandpa was really the model of humanity. He never said a bad word about anyone. Never. And after 3 years at Dachau concentration camp, observing hundreds of atrocities, I thought he had reason to hate just about everyone, but no. Never a bad word. Not even for those who may have deserved it. And that's what he used words because he was a man of very few. For example, he used to bring home M&Ms for me every day, and he would simply shake the bag over my head pew, 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 while I was sitting on the floor, laying on the floor watching Leave It to Beaver. I was 14, walking down the street one day, smoking a cigarette that I stole from my mother when I saw my grandfather walking toward me up the hill. Oh, my God, you know, this is what's the chance of this? Stunned by his presence, I looked at him only to see him gesture, waving his finger. No, 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 no. Don't you ever do that again. He never ratted on me. My most cherished memory was a story that he told me every year without fail, starting when I was 5, about a watch that he had. It's a story that I sometimes tell in other circumstances. Story was is that when I was about 5 years old, he used to tell me the story that he had this gold watch that he kept in his sock while he was in Dachau concentration camp. Now, I was a kid, so I really didn't know what he was talking about. But he told me the story every year, year in and year out, never fail. The story was that he had this gold watch that he kept in his sock because he had his clothing, so he was a laborer. And the watch reminded him of what he kept in his sock so the Nazis wouldn't steal it, but more importantly, it was a symbol of hope that he would one day run across my mother and my grandmother, who were separated. Now, I heard that story 21 times. A few months after the last telling, when I was 26 years old, he was diagnosed with leukemia. We were optimistic because many older people survive certain types of leukemia, but it wasn't to be. I was in the hospital room the last day of his life. and it was around 8 p.m. I found myself and my grandfather alone in the room, smothered in silence. And as I looked at my grandfather lying there, I saw him turn cold with a soft blue hue and then white. And I knew what just happened. But I walked over to him and I placed my hand over his face to feel a sign of life, and I whispered, "Grandpa." And then I felt a chill just before my body jerked to the left, and I saw in the corner of my eye an aura. It was a visible steam-like substance, not unlike what we see coming from a tea kettle. And then it disappeared. A few days later, at my grandfather's funeral, a good friend of the family came up to me and handed me a small box, cotton-laced, and in it was that watch from the 20-plus year stories. And it was a watch that I never knew that he still had. And under the watch was a small piece of scratch paper that read, "I love you," which was typical of him because there was no wasted words. It was simple and honest. And everything that my grandfather did was fueled by his kind and gentle soul, and that's why it hurt so much to watch it leave. So.
Thank you, Hank.
Wow. Thank you.
I've never heard anything like that before.
Mm-mm. Nicole, how do you collect or document your stories to tell or to write?
Wow. I'm still in your story right now.
Sure.
And,
me too.
Yeah.
But it goes back to kind of the compulsion that I spoke about earlier of telling the story. It's the same way when I write. It's just the stories, they just start playing in my head and I have to get them out. So a lot of times I will record on my phone and then type it later because I might be driving down the road or wherever. And so.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I use bonnie paper towels, whatever I can get a hold of it, so I can eventually document it in a script. What do you do when someone says to you, "I'd like to tell stories, but I'm not very interesting"?
Well, you know, Mary Carroll, my girlfriend, is a she's a wonderful speaker, and she doesn't think she is. And she's a Zen practitioner of Zen Buddhism, and so she she's a thoughtful person, and I got her to do a little talk about being she's a biologist and encountering a baby gator that she said was the size of a puppy, you know, and just what a great thing to say, the size of a puppy, a gator the size of a puppy. And I know she would say that to her. She probably wouldn't even say, "I like to tell stories," because I don't think she's not like me where I like attention. but she has something to say, and she is super thoughtful. And so I would just say that to people that say, "Well, I what was your question?" It was, I'd like to tell stories, but I'm not very interesting. Those people are usually really interesting.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
It's like, damn it.
It's like whatever you say, you can expect that. So in other words, if someone says, "I don't mean to sound offensive," you know something's going to be offensive, right?
Right.
If they say, "I don't want to sound like a racist," bank on the fact that what they're about to say is a racist.
Right.
And they say, "I don't really have anything interesting." Get ready to fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be riveting. It's going to be dynamic.
Yeah, I know.
But I get that a lot, you know, teaching and stuff. I get students who all the time say, you know, "I have nothing interesting to say." And I have so many examples of how what you just said, Harwood, that people are, in fact, interesting. I just want to tell this real quick story. I remember a student who said to me, "You know, I don't have anything interesting. I know that the assignment is to tell a personal narrative in a basic storytelling class, but I have nothing to say." I said, "Well, tell me a little bit about what's going on in your life." And he says, "You don't want to know." And that means what? "Yeah, I do." So he tells me, "Well, I mean, for one thing, I'm mad at my dad." I said, "Why?" "Because he recently died, and I was one of the people who had to decide to let him go, and I was really angry with him because I used to wait for him every night when he would get home at 5:30 because he loved me so much, and I really wanted him to be there, and now suddenly he's not." I said, wait a minute.
Right.
What are you talking about? This is the most
good stuff.
This is fabulous. So, you know, we kind of carved it out, and it turned out it was just, it was a magnificent story.
Yeah.
And it just works out that way. It just works out that way. Who was the storytelling in your homes growing up? Joanne, did you have a storytelling person in your home?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was that?
My dad was a great
What kind of stories did he tell you?
About growing up just dirt poor in a tiny town in Colorado.
We're in Colorado.
Colorado. His parents were immigrants from Italy.
Yeah, from Italy?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay.
And he used to tell us just crazy stories.
Yeah.
Crazy stories. Running around with all of his friends, and they all had these wild Italian last names. You know, Luigi, Carmelo. I mean, just on and on.
Yeah.
We just were riveted.
Yeah.
He's
fabulous.
A great storyteller.
Yeah.
He would often cry at the end of all
of
his stories.
He would cry at his own story. It's like laughing at your own joke. I know. Sometimes you have to.
Yeah.
Sometimes it... stories, you know, I always talk about them stretching the boundaries of a human heart. I always end a show talking about that in many ways, because in fact, that's what happens. They really do stretch the boundaries of the human heart.
Yeah.
Howard, what about you? A storyteller growing up?
Yeah, definitely my dad. And my dad talked about
I remember asking you that
his
before.
Uncle Tom.
Yeah.
And Uncle Tom was a big, so he told me a lot of Uncle Tom stories. It was just his uncle that lived in the house with them.
Yeah.
He was my dad also sang songs. He was very entertaining.
What
he would
about
say,
you,
that reminds me of a song, and then he would
storytelling growing up.
I would say my grandma Holloway, the one who I visited in the graveyard out there growing up. We would go with her to take care of the graveyard, and those were always kind of the times I heard all the stories about you know, her childhood or family I never met, things like that. So I don't think she would have considered herself that, but I do.
Yeah.
This was a great show.
Yeah,
I can never believe when it's almost over. You know, we think an hour, you know, but my God, this was a great show.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nicole Holloway Spafford, Joanne Williams, and Harwood Taylor for stories that again reinforce how stories stretch the boundaries of the human heart. Well, this is a perfect outro. Boomers and anyone with any taste, the Seekers, 1968, a great sing-along. I'll never find another you. Stay put, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson Tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we're going to just keep bringing them to you. This is Dr. Hank, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
For each of us, they say, and you be.
decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.